From the New York City area, welcome to the Badass Counseling Show, where the master badass himself, Sven Erlandsson, takes you deep and gives balm for the soul, baby.
Rock and roll hoochie-coo. Here we go, fine humans. My name is Sven Erlandsson, and I am the host of the Badass Counseling Show. You found us. For better or for worse, you are now officially stuck with us till you realize I'm an idiot and you decide to go elsewhere. But it's good to have you here while we have you. Whether you are tuning in from the beaches somewhere, some beach somewhere, or you are driving along the Pacific Coast Highway admiring all the beaches and past Pismo Beach and so forth, or whether you are driving down the Merritt Parkway enjoying the bridges, it's great to have you here. I am joined in studio by KC over in the booth, silent and deadly. And right next to me is Rob the Rocket. Rob.
Yes.
Rob.
Hello.
What do you say, man?
I say whether you are afraid of the sun or a real son of the beach, you are welcome.
You are just the cleverest, fine little person you are.
Glad you finally realized it.
I've always known Roberto. Rob, I can't find my water. Where's my ding dong it? Oh, there it is. Okay.
KC, so, get him his water.
Now, yeah, I would never expect KC to do my bidding. I know better. All right. So, folks, we have a really fascinating show today, a hurtful show, a sad show on one hand, but a hope-inspiring show, I think. We're about to meet Jane Susan. Rob, tell us about Jane Susan.
All right. Jane Susan wrote in and said, first, I'd like to thank you. The work you do is beyond measure. I know I need to journal, but one, I don't know which box to unwrap first, and two, I'm scared of what else I'll find. I was misdiagnosed with terminal glioblastoma at age 17 and given a few months to live. Surprise, I'm 48 and still here. Prior to that, I was abused by my mother's best friend's husband. I never told anyone and carried the guilt and shame for years. It shaped many of my future failed relationships. I married at 22. I didn't love him like I should, but he was good to me at the time, and I really didn't think I'd live a long time. We had three girls, then divorced when my youngest was two. I asked for the divorce because I couldn't stand being alone in marriage. He said he had a license to demand sex. Left me alone at the hospital when our youngest had MRSA to go to work. That was the theme of our marriage. I put myself into bankruptcy so my oldest could play ice hockey. My middle daughter became depressed and suicidal at age 15. My youngest daughter was diagnosed with cancer at age 15. She's in remission now and deciding what college to attend. My ex talks shit to my girls about me. Once my oldest graduated from high school, it was like she suddenly didn't like me anymore. Our relationship is strained at best. I've always been the one who was okay, smile on my face, push forward, make everyone else happy. I'm definitely a people pleaser.
Jane Susan, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming on. Let's go ahead and dive in, get to work. I want to ask you right away, you said you were misdiagnosed with terminal glioblastoma at 17. My girlfriend's cousin died a couple years ago of glioblastoma, and we moved her close to us so that we could take care of her. I know what a savage disease that is, but I do not know what a savage disease it isn't when you're misdiagnosed with it. So I want you to tell me what above all else, because that is essentially glioblastoma, terminal means, of course, they were telling you at 17, you're going to die, right? And so I want to know, if you were to really distill it down to one sentence, what was the effect on that 17-year-old at that moment and moving forward of being of receiving that diagnosis? What really was the impact?
It's hard to say because I was always taught, let me preface this with saying, so my mother is British and we were always taught that, you know, you stuff your feelings down. You're not allowed to have feelings. So it was kind of like, well, you know, this happened to you and, you know, now you're not going to die. So you pick up the pieces and you move on and you don't talk about it.
But wait a minute. Before you get on to the you're not going to die, I want to know of the effect. Misdiagnosis implies you got a diagnosis and that you lived with that diagnosis until you discovered it was not accurate. When did you get the actual diagnosis of glioblastoma?
So my senior year of high school.
Right. And then when did you discover it wasn't true? When was it cleared up?
So that all happened like October of my senior year. And then I think it was somewhere around January, like kind of like all in that time, they were trying to figure out exactly what was wrong with me. And then I don't remember the exact time frame because it all happened very quickly. But in that time, they were like, oh my God, it's glioblastoma. You know, she's going to be lucky if she lives. All kinds of doctors, surgeries planned. And then maybe it was sometime in December, they were like, okay, we were wrong. And they were trying to hide it from me. But I kind of knew, you know, like this is bad because my brother was in the Navy and he came home on emergency leave. And that's kind of when I knew, like, okay, this is bad. And my mother's best friend was like, yeah, it's bad. And
so wait a minute. So that all that happened in October. So for 2 months, you knew it was bad. They didn't tell you that you were going to die yet. Okay. But then in December, they realize, oops, December, January, they go, oops, and you're not going to die and so forth. And so massive roller coaster for internally, because you just said your mom's British and she said no feelings for you. What do you think then in that roller coaster, looking back on that time of realizing it was bad, what was the single worst part about it?
You know, it was my senior year of high school. It was supposed to be like the best time of my life. And it was just like everything was taken away from me. And, you know, I didn't know how to process the feelings. I had nowhere to go with them. Like when I read your book and you said, you know, that box that's, you know, wrapped up in the pretty little bow in the depths of the basement, I actually, you know, it's not funny, but I laughed because I'm like, oh boy, isn't that true?
Right. What do you think was the single biggest feeling you were feeling at that time that got jammed down?
Scared. I was just so scared.
And was it just scared of death or scared of not knowing what's going to happen? What do you think the real scared was?
Scared of death, scared of not knowing what's going to happen, not knowing who to trust. You know, when you've got, you know, all this family around you and no one telling you what's actually happening.
Mm. Have you ever done any sort of counseling or journaling or anything on that period of your life, let alone everything else, but specifically on that period of life, or is all the shit still in there?
It's all still in there. Wow. You know, it's, you know, again, back to your book, you know, when you say you can run and it's eventually going to catch up with you. You know, I've been running my entire life. You just, you know, I always was taught, you know, you just keep on moving forward.
Presumably you've run by partly staying busy or, you know, parenting and all the million things you got to drive your daughters to, et cetera, et cetera. Maybe you've worked as well. What has been the impact of all the running?
Probably never figuring out who I really am, never being my authentic self, pleasing everybody else, making sure everybody else is okay, and never worrying about me.
And that raises the most interesting question then, I think, at least in the opening of your paragraph, and that is you said, I know I need to journal, but one, I don't know which box to unwrap first, but two, I'm scared of what else I'll find. What are you most scared of finding inside of you? Why would you have fear at all? What makes you think there's bad things down there?
Because I feel like I'm running from so much. Like, you know, what else is there? There's been so much bad, you know. I don't know what else is in
there. Okay, fair enough. You don't know what's in there. Let me ask you this. What is the biggest thing you fear happening if you were to actually go in and get after it?
I think all the feelings.
Right. And especially if you've been, you know, raised, to your point, by a British mother, and I don't know how your dad was with feelings, but maybe both of them sort of live that way of no feelings or whatever. You just don't have experience feeling them. It's like, it's so disorienting. It's like, you know, riding a horse for the first time. It's like, it's beautiful. I want to learn how to ride, but it's just, it's scary and I don't know what to do and where do I put my foot and, you know, all those things. Does that somewhat resonate?
Oh, absolutely.
Right, right. And likely the fear of being overwhelmed by the feelings as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Totally understandable and where to even start, et cetera, et cetera. Well, let's go into the rest of the story then. You say you were abused by your mother's best friend's husband. I'm going to assume that means sexually.
Yes.
And yes. How old were you when that happened?
It was right around the time after my diagnosis and then I was cleared. I would nanny for them. And because they had an adopted daughter and I would stay at their house and he would sneak into my room in the mornings before he went to work when everyone was sleeping. So he was well aware of my diagnosis and everything I went through because, you know, she was there for me through everything.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. What an absolute piece of shit. Wow. Oh, yeah. I am so fucking sorry. Jeez. God. Oh, my God. On top of all the stuff, I'm so sorry for all the incompetence and of the you know, and how medicine let you down. And then this on top of it, good Lord, I want to ask you, and you don't have to answer any of these questions. When it comes to the sexual abuse, you don't have to answer. Lick of it, just say, Sven, go fuck yourself. I won't be offended. I totally get it, all right? But I want to ask the questions, all right? You have every right to say, no, I don't want to, I don't feel comfortable. That's totally okay. Did you tell anyone, tell your mother or anything like that?
When I was so ashamed. And, at that age, I thought it was my fault because, I was a teen. I was, 17, 18 years old. And, the way I dressed and, it made me feel like it was, it was my fault and I asked for it. And it's I know now, but it, took me years to realize that, that was all him. It had nothing to do with me.
How old do you think you were when you realized it was all him being a piece of shit and it had nothing to do with you? How old do you think you were when you realized that?
In my 30s.
Wow. And what finally, because you said, I never told anyone and you carried the guilt and the shame for years. Let me ask you this. What caused you to finally realize it was his fault and it was all him and he was just this piece of crap?
I do a lot of reading and, like a lot of self-help and, things like listening to your podcast and, try to, to me, it's all about making myself better each day. Mm-hmm. So just trying to do stuff to help myself and get myself through it.
So you were in your 30s doing some of this stuff and you read something or something and it just sort of hit you?
Yeah. And just kind of realized that, it's nothing that, I could have ever done that, he's just an incredible piece of shit.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Let me ask you, Jane Susan, you said I never told anyone. Who was the first person you ever told?
My best friend.
And how was it received?
Oh, she was same reaction like you had, what an absolute piece of shit.
Good.
And,
Good. So you felt safe and it was received and you could unburden yourself. And obviously you feel much more comfortable talking about it now. What would you say was the single biggest impact for you? And every survivor of abuse experiences different impacts. So there's no right or wrong answer. I just want to know what was the biggest impact for you? If you were to boil it down to one sentence, the impact of the sexual abuse, on your future relationships?
I always sought attention and validation. And, I've definitely, had the attention of men and, used sex as validation. And the older I get, the more I realize, I think a lot of it had to do with that. And I'm not sure what the ties are.
Let me ask you, what are the ties? Why? I mean, because to some degree, that is not that uncommon of an experience to use sex for attention. On one hand, all right, there's some measure of normal to it, but you're linking the two, and that's okay. And I want you to speculate why, knowing you could change your mind in 5 seconds, 5 minutes, 5 years, if you want. You can always change your mind. I just want you to speculate. What do you think the reason is that you've always, that it has shaped you in terms of, the failing of your relationships and seeking the attention of men? What's the link between the sexual abuse and that?
I think because, he would tell me, well, this is your fault because it's the way you dress. It's the attention that you're seeking. So I think it's, the things that he would say to me. Mm. And I think, he kind of planted that seed in the back of my head.
And by he, you mean the man who was sexually abusing you? Yeah. Right. Yeah. And which, of course, all of that is garbage. And then how did that plant a seed inside of you in terms of ruining your future relationships or shaping your future failed relationships?
Because I always seem to seek out the wrong type of man.
And is it that you all also attribute the problems in the relationship to you?
Oh yeah, absolutely.
There we go.
Yeah, I take everything on. I always look to see what did I do? It's never them. It's always me.
Well, and the truth is, I mean, in a healthy relationship or in a relationship of mutuality, you have to have that. There has to be that. And am I holding the other person accountable for how they're treating me? So it's two people saying, well, how am I fucking up this equation? And how do I need to hold the other person accountable for how they're treating me? So it's both. But if you have someone that's just saying, yeah, it's you. And if you're already predispositioned, if you've already been conditioned by your rapist, and I shouldn't use the word your, but the person who raped you, the scumbag that raped you, if you've already been preconditioned to believe it's your fault, then if you walk into a relationship with somebody who's happy to take advantage of that, you know, you're fucked. You're fucked.
Right.
What percent does that mentality still govern your life, that it all the bad stuff is my fault?
40%.
Wow. All right. So I want to move forward here. In what way, what was the biggest way you were alone in the marriage?
So he was a firefighter. You know, mm-hmm. we had three young kids and everything was about his job. I did everything alone, you know, weddings, birthday parties, no matter what it was, he was always at work. And he used to say to me, well, it's not like I'm cheating on you. I'm providing for the family. But everything I did alone. And he, and basically like every decision I made, he would undermine my decision and question my decision. But I was like, well, you're not here. So I need to make the decisions for, you know, the kids and, you know, what's happening because you're not here.
Right. And so he would undermine your decisions. And let me ask you, did you, hard word, but did you allow that?
Oh, absolutely.
And so is there a correlation then between him undermining your decisions? You're allowing that. And I'm not saying it's your fault. Him doing that is 100% his fault. Okay. But the thing is, the first time I allowed, the second time I allowed, if I don't stand up, then it only gets worse and worse and worse as you have lived. And obviously that's been conditioned by, you know, your past that says it's your fault, it's your fault, it's your fault. Has the undermining of your parenting decisions, isn't that sort of what's been going on then in his undermining you and your relationship with your kids? It's the exact same thing. And so you're sort of allowing it, the fact that you've been allowing him to mistreat you all these years, this mistreatment in him turning the girls against you, has that been a hard habit to break, to stand up for yourself and say, no, you can't do this?
Yeah, very hard.
And what percent do you think you've broken that? That fear of standing up and that sort of allowing all this shit, what percent do you feel like you have broken that?
40, 50%. It's been a work in progress. It's definitely gotten better, but it's such a hard habit to break.
It is. I sort of giggle because you know the song by Chicago, right? You probably were giggling about it, right. Yeah, hard habit to break. It's actually a great song. And the coda on that song, there's a second song on the end of it that is one of my favorite songs. That one was by Bob Lamb. Anyway, sorry about that. My brain just goes, they're my favorite group of all time. So you say hard habit to break. Anyway, and so that's the aloneness in the marriage. And then you get into talking about your daughters. Now, before I move on to the daughter part, because I want to ask you, and this is going to sound like a dumb question, but I excel at dumb questions. So why did you write into the show? What ultimately is the one question you are trying to answer, to try to find resolution to? What really is gripping the fuck out of your soul? What really are we talking about?
Feel like I have failed. When I left my marriage, one of my biggest things was, you know, I want to show my kids that, you know, especially having three girls, you know, that you can do this alone. You don't need to rely on anybody else. It was very, very important to me. And now here I am, and I've got, you know, two grown daughters and one who's graduating from high school. I have a very good relationship with the youngest. The middle one is getting better, and the oldest one is horrible. And I feel like I've done them such an injustice, and I don't know where I went wrong. And
feel like you've done them an injustice? Because they don't like you right? Because your oldest doesn't like you right now and you're still working on a relationship with your middle one? Or why do you think you've done them an injustice?
Because I don't like, you know, I don't know, like if they feel like if I stayed with their father, it would have been better. And like deep down inside, I know it wouldn't have been, but like, I don't know what to do to make the relationship better. And I keep trying, you know, to work on myself every day and make myself better. And, you know I wasn't the best mother all the time because I had all these things that I was trying to deal with myself and I didn't know how to deal with them. I don't know where to go from here.
Why do you think you need to go anywhere? What do you think you need? What's missing or what do you think you need to accomplish?
I don't know if I owe them an apology. I don't know what to do for them.
Okay. And is it that you don't know what to do for them Or is it that you don't know what to do to repair the relationship?
I don't know what to do to repair the relationship.
There it is. There it is. Is it possible that what's really aching the most or causing you to write into our show, which is great, glad you did, is that you're sad because your daughters don't like you and it makes you sad. And so as you are so good at doing, it must be my fault. I must have done something wrong. I'm at fault, you know. And so, but it hurts your heart that your daughters aren't close to you, perhaps as they were in the past. Is that really what we're talking about, or tweak it? Is it something else?
Yeah, it's that. And it's, you know, also again, like I've stuffed all these things down so far, you know, the trauma of all of it, you know, I don't know how to deal with it. I was listening to one of your episodes, and I don't remember which one it was now, but you know, about somebody being abused as a child. And I was like, what? And I cried through the entire episode because it just, it resonated with me so much. And I'm like, I don't know how to deal with these things.
Fair enough. Fair enough. And we're going to attack exactly that right after this short break.
I've been doing some real healing work in my life, and I mean hardcore, but I've been craving something new to level up. A friend of mine told me about this badass counselor. I gotta admit, I rolled my eyes. Then I watched a few of his videos, and yes, this is the guy. I went and got his audiobook, Badass Wisdom. Holy shit. Absolute ass-kicking, inspiring, deep, powerful shit, period. If you don't get this book, you're making a huge mistake. So do you got the guts to go big with your self-care? Go to badasscounseling.com, get the book Badass Wisdom now.
This show provides soul counseling intended to entertain and inform and is not medical advice. Now, back to the badass.
We are back with Jane Susan. Jane Susan, I want to ask you, you said that you have stuffed your trauma down so far and for so long. And of course, it's not just the the misdiagnosis of the glioblastoma, not just the sexual abuse, which was horrible. The rape is, let's call it what it is. But also you set it up by saying, you know, mom was British and taught us no feelings. Now, I love the Brits. I really do. But you're talking about your experience of your mother and stuff those feelings down. And you say right at the beginning, you know, I know I need a journal, don't know where to start, and I'm scared of what I'll find. And then you just said, now I've stuffed trauma down so far. And what makes you think, just briefly, what makes you think you actually need to go into all that stuff? Apart from hearing me say it or reading it in self-help books or whatever, what is it that makes you think that that's what you need to do? I mean, why not just go on about life without it?
I feel like it comes up and it affects so many things in my life.
How? You know, you give me an example.
The way I, you know, react to things and, you know, in relationships, and I'm so sensitive about, you know, certain things. My boyfriend tells me all the time, like, you know, you're so overly sensitive, and he's very good and he understands me, you know, a great deal, but you know, he tells me all the time, like, you know, we talk about, you know, how sensitive I am. And I think, God, I really am like sensitive. But then I know why I'm so sensitive.
Okay, first of all, why are you so sensitive in one sentence or less?
I take everything so personally.
Okay, fair. And two, is being so sensitive bad?
No, but I mean, again, it always goes back to like, it's like I take everything like as a personal attack. And then I'm like, well, what did I do wrong? Like, how can I fix it? You know, like it goes, and then it goes back to the people pleasing. You know, I want everybody to like me. I want everyone around me to be okay. I'm always making sure that everyone else is taken care of.
You've got a love cup. Okay. We all are going through life trying to get our love cup filled. Every single one of us, whether we're aware of it or not, we're all trying to get attention, approval, acceptance, affection, et cetera, et cetera. And your love cup, because you've experienced so much pain in your life, and so many people have, okay? There's a lot of pain in the world, and you've experienced so much pain of such a distinct variety. I mean, a diagnosis of a brain fucking tumor, basically, and killing you, et cetera, at 17, at what should be, you know, Greece, and hey, let's roll on the beach together, and let's, you know, all those things that we're supposed to be doing when we're 17. and robbed from you, not to mention the shit before that. Because here's the thing. If you're growing up with, if you've got a massive traumatic event at age 17 and you have a parent saying, basically, tough it up, move forward, shut the fuck up, let's go get to work, basically. If she's doing it for a major event, and we haven't even brought your dad into the picture yet. We don't even know what his role was. But if she's doing it with a major event at 17, that means she has been doing it with all the small, medium, and large stuff prior to that. So you didn't get the message at 17. Hell no. You got the message at 1. You got the message at 3. No tears. You know, don't have time for that. Your anger. Yeah, I'll give you something to be really angry about, kiddo. Keep doing what you're doing. Whatever it is, you've been stuffing that shit down your whole life. That means inside of your love cup is all of the shit and all of the pain and all of the anger and all of the sadness and all of the crud you could ever possibly stick into a love cup. It's all in there. It's all jammed in your love cup. And what that means is one more drop, just a drop of pain, just a drop of hurt, of anger, of offending you or whatever, fires all those fucking pistons, all those neurons, all those electric vibe shit inside your love cup. It all gets triggered because you are walking around with 100 sticks of fucking dynamite inside of you. Every one of them has a fuse, and every last thing in the world is either a lighter or a match or a torch just waiting to blow up some shit inside of you. Does that mean you're bad? No, not at all. Does it mean it's your fault? Zero. No, it has nothing to do with any of that. You're sensitive because everything hurts. Everything hurts because you've had so much pain that you haven't gotten out of you. Does that resonate? Sound like total bullshit? What?
Oh, no, that's 100% so dead on.
Right. Right. And so you asked the question. So it must have been a real, real kick in the head, as they used to say back in the 40s or in the Sinatra song, a real kick in the head, a real hole in the boat. It must have been a real kick in the head when you get to basically chapter one of my book and I say, so journal about the single most traumatic event of your life. And you're like, oh yeah, that's fucking funny. I'll just skip this journaling shit. Right? Roughly? Ballpark?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. So let me ask you. Off the top of your head, single most top of the list, painful, traumatic, life-riveting event or experience of your entire life. Is it your daughter being suicidal at 15? Is it you, that glioblastoma diagnosis at 17? Is it your mom or maybe your dad really hurting you deeply at age 5? Is it, your husband leaving you in the hospital or demanding sex? Was it the rapes? What tops the list for you?
I think it was my daughter being diagnosed with cancer because it was she was 15 and it was so similar. Even though it wasn't glioblastoma, it was so similar to what I went through and I was so helpless. It just brought it all back and it was such a hopeless feeling.
All right. Let me ask you this. And this is a weird question, but it's an honest question. And if you don't want to answer it, don't answer it. It's totally cool, but it's an honest question. Why was daughter being diagnosed with cancer at 15? That's your youngest daughter. Why was that more painful, more traumatic for you than middle daughter being depressed and suicidal at 15? I'm not saying it shouldn't be. I'm just asking why.
Right. I think it was, I don't know if it was because it was just one more thing or it was just because it was similar to what I went through. I don't know. It was just like the tip of the iceberg, I guess. And, there was nothing I could do.
Right. And of course, it doesn't mean you love your younger daughter more than your middle daughter or some crap like that. It doesn't mean that at all. I was just curious. Okay. And so let me ask you, as you think about your daughter's diagnosis of cancer and your own helplessness in that situation, as you think about it right now, what are you feeling? And maybe it's nothing, and that's totally okay. I just want to know, is your heart beating faster? Are your pits sweating? Are you nervous? Are you excited? It can be a physical sensation. It can be an emotional feeling. What are you feeling right now as we talk about this notion of your daughter being diagnosed with cancer at age 15 and how similar it was to your own experience at 17?
It makes my heart beat a little bit faster, and it's a little bit overwhelming still.
What's the most overwhelming part thinking about your daughter being diagnosed with cancer at 15?
It was just so hard to watch her go through that, just to, you know, watch, you know, almost 2 years of her life, you know, as a, you know, she started out as a thriving teenager, and watch almost 2 years of her life, you know, being taken away from her. It's, you know, no child should have to go through that.
Agreed. What was the single hardest part about that? About watching her lose 2 years of her life and the fear in her eyes and the pain in her eyes and your own helplessness and everything else and the impacts on her sisters and in watching the whole thing. What was the hardest part?
I think watching her try to come back from it and, you know, get back into the normal life and just watch her struggle and, you know, knowing as a mom that there wasn't much I could do for her. Yeah.
Just out of curiosity, did you right the wrongs of the past? And that is, your mom didn't encourage you to talk it out and zip, and she said, zip your lip and all that sort of thing. Let me ask you, Jane Susan, how did you deal with your daughter's feelings when she was going through it and trying to come out of it?
We talk about it all the time.
But what about the feelings aspect specifically? Is she allowed and encouraged to have her feelings? Are you facilitating?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
How did you do it? For a person who claims to know nothing about feelings and has had them shut down her entire life, how'd you do it?
I always tell her, you know, talk about how you feel and tell her, you know, you're entitled to have feelings around things. And, you know, I've taught her to have a voice and speak up for herself and, you know, advocate for herself and, you know, she to tell people how she feels.
Playfully, I got to say, that's a bit ironic coming from you, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
And I'm just being silly there. But that's great that you did it. You came through for her. And so let me ask you then, I want to come back then to sort of where it is today. And your biggest fear today is what? In all this equation with all three of your daughters, is the fear that they don't like you? Is it fear and that they won't still won't like you? Not just what's the biggest pain right now, because we've sort of already established, it sounds like, that there's breaches in those two older relationships, especially the one with the oldest. But what is the single biggest fear gripping your, either regarding this or basically the biggest fear in your life right now? What is your single biggest fear gripping your life right now?
That I'm not liked, that, you know, I still have to do like acts of service. I don't know how to explain it, but like, you know, do things so like people will like me. You know what I mean? Like it goes back to that people pleasing.
And where did you get the message above all else? What is the original source of you getting the message that you're being liked is tied up in your doing and not in your being? That you have to do things to earn love or to make people like you. Where do you think you got that message?
I mean, I know growing up, you know, it was like, you know, my brother and I were supposed to be, you know, seen and not heard.
Okay. And
sure.
Okay. Seen and not heard. And were there expectations for what you, were you praised for doing good things and were you, or, and were punished for doing bad things?
Well, absolutely.
Okay. Was your worth confirmed just for being wonderful and sweet little Jane Susan when you were growing up?
Oh, no, we had to earn it.
And what was the biggest way you always felt in your life you had to earn it? By doing what?
You know, if we did what we were told to do.
And what generally were you told to do?
Oh, you know, we had to do our chores. And when my parents were married, which was a short time because they got divorced when I was very young. But when my parents were married, my mother was a stay-at-home mom. My dad worked. He was never home. And when he was home, my mother was, you know, he was in business. So when he was home, and I was young, but as far as I could remember, like she would do all the stuff to prepare for like the dinner parties on a Friday night and have his colleagues over. Mm-hmm. So my brother and I weren't allowed to be around for that. So we, you know, had to, you know, make sure that we were in our rooms and away for things like that. And, you know, she would clean the house and we weren't allowed in the room, like, you know, in the living room, the vacuum lines were perfect. We weren't allowed in that room kind of thing. And we grew up in Minnesota at that time. And that was the time where, you know.
Okay, fair enough. And the lines in the carpet, you know, vacuum lines, my neighbor, the mom used to rake their carpet. They had a carpet rake.
Yes.
And all the lines. So I get it. I guess where I'm going with all of this is, If you were to boil it down to one sentence message about yourself that you got from your father and the one sentence message you got from your mother about yourself, what was the message?
Never good enough.
Which parent?
My mother.
Never good enough. And what was the single message, whether it was ever spoken or not, what was the message from dad?
It's weird because they got divorced when I was so young and our relationship has been so up and down. He's been in my life, out of my life, sometimes by my choice, sometimes by his choice.
And so that was prevalent in your childhood and teen years?
Yeah. I mean, he's been, you know, he cheated on my mom. He's been married 3 times.
And so let me ask you, what is the underlying message that got conveyed to the child?
See, I don't remember. I don't know.
No. I'm just asking you based on the actions. It wouldn't have been something you were even potentially aware of at the time. I'm asking you, when a parent is in and out of a child, did your father convey the message that you matter?
When it was convenient for him. He always tries to, like, you know, pretend like, you know, oh, you're daddy's little girl. And
he would do that, or he does that presently?
Both.
But well, I want to know back then, because the patterns got set in place back then. I want to know what fundamentally was the message. If he did it when it was convenient for him, that tells me you wanted more of him and he wasn't there to give it. He only gave it at his own when he wanted it, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
So isn't that conveying the message to the child? Isn't the child getting the message then that my needs, my wants, my feelings aren't important?
Yeah, that's accurate.
Right.
Yeah.
So you're getting the message from dad that you're not important. I mean, it felt great when you were. It felt great, I'm sure, when he wanted interaction with you. But the underlying message, and the child's not even fucking aware of it, perhaps, but they're getting the message. I'm clearly not important enough for him to care about my feelings and my wants and my needs. Accurate or inaccurate?
Yeah, and I think that's accurate. And I think that's probably why, like, I couldn't pinpoint it, because I don't remember what the message was or how it came about.
Exactly. Exactly. And this is the critical piece. See, it's not that the messages are explicit. More often than not, they're implicit. And that's why it really requires looking at the movie of your life with adult eyes to see how would a child feel. Okay, and then you say you got the message from your mom that you're never good enough, that you're not good enough. Well, if you're never good enough, do you know what the underlying message is? For instance, if you were to tell your, I'll just pick one of your daughters, if you were to tell your oldest daughter, you really should get a better job, or why do you dress like that? Or, oh my God, are you putting on weight? You know, if you were to be doing constantly,
like my mother.
Okay, fair. Well, then, okay, if you were to do that to your daughter is probably getting the message, I'm not good enough, right? Right. But the underlying message under that, anytime I'm telling someone you should, what I'm telling them is, I don't like who you are right now. You should go do that. You should lose weight. You should change your clothing. You should get a different haircut. You should work a better job. You should go to a better school. You should is implying I don't like who you are right now.
Wow. Okay.
Bingo. And so that even if the child does not cognate that, even if it doesn't register as those words, the feel of it registers. Isn't that interesting that they may not even think, oh, you just fucking said you don't like me. And maybe some kids will, some adults will, but a lot won't. But it feels, I mean, and it's clear how anyone would get that message. If you're telling me, Sven, you should really do this with your show. And Sven, oh my God, can you please just do something with the face part and whatever else, Sven, you're saying, I don't like who you are right now. And it's easy as a parent to cloak it under, oh, I'm just trying to help you become better. Yeah, but you're still saying you don't fucking like who I am. How does it feel right now? You just had an oh shit experience. You just had a holy shit moment. What registered inside of you? How does it feel to hear that you fundamentally got the message, I don't like who you are?
It's kind of a relief, because I'm like, wow, Like, that all makes so much sense. Like, now I get it.
And
like,
what are you getting? What's making sense to help clue us in, bring us inside of you?
It's validating to know that, like, I'm not crazy. Like, I was getting these messages and I feel this way for a reason. And it's a relief to be like, wow, like, okay, it's not me.
Exactly.
It was them.
And here's the thing, and you just fucking nailed it. Brilliant stated. Brilliant, brilliant, Jane Susan. And so think about this. The child's brain basically says, mom and dad are good, and they love me. So therefore, if I'm not getting love from them, there must be something wrong with me. And if they're actually saying, well, there is something wrong with you, you need to this and that, and dad is basically saying the message, you're not that fucking important. So it's like, oh my God, I suck. I'm unimportant and so on and so forth. Mom and dad are good. They love me. So if I'm not getting love, I know they do because they're good people. So if I'm not getting love, clearly I'm the problem. But then as we really go back and watch the movie of our life that Steven Spielberg has made of our life and named it Jane Susan, and you're watching that movie of your life and you're wait, they were fucked. That's fucked up what they were doing. That's fucked up the messages they were sending me. Maybe they weren't either A, good people, or B, good parents. Maybe they weren't. Maybe my fundamental premise that they're good and they love me, what if that is wrong? What if they didn't love me? What if my mom actually didn't like me and she fundamentally was stating it? I don't like who you are. So maybe the mouth says, oh, I love my daughters. I love my daughter. I love my daughter. But the actions are saying, change this. I don't like this. I don't like that. Or maybe it's worse even. Okay. And dad's not protecting you. Clearly somebody's not fucking making you feel protected if you're being raped repeatedly and don't feel comfortable talking about it. There's no protection of your emotional life so that all your fears and all your pain, because I'm telling you, if a child, I don't care how good a mask or actor a child is, if you are abused, if you are touched inappropriately sexually as a child, an in-tune parent fucking knows. An in-tune parent knows. When my kids are growing up, if my kid got pushed at school, I saw it on their face when they come home. You know. Yeah. My son got twirled around and thrown into a log and split his head open. I didn't need to see the split head to know, holy shit. You know, children are there. I don't care how good they are cloaking. You know, your parents would have seen a marked difference. If they were tuned in, they would have seen a marked difference. Okay. So we're back. And yet it didn't register. Nobody gave a shit, right? But if they had been protecting your emotions, protecting the child is number one goal, to protect not just their body and their sexuality and all that, but their soul and their feelings. And yours weren't being protected. So here's what we have. The original premise is mom and dad are good. Mom and dad love me. If I'm not getting love, something's wrong with me. Now we're realizing, holy shit, they weren't good parents. Dad was fucking in. He was out. He fucked up big time. Whether or not they're good people isn't even the point. The point is they really fucked up his parents and your mom too. And well, wait, if they fucked up his parents, then maybe the reason I wasn't getting love had nothing to do with me. You are a good, sweet, kind, rambunctious, playful, creative, intelligent, snotty at times. You are a normal kid. There was nothing wrong with you. Yet you've been conditioned your entire life to believe that there was, when the problem was never you to begin with. It wasn't your fault. How does that feel?
I don't even know. It's unbelievable. Like, to hear that, it's a huge relief.
What crime could a 5-year-old, an 8-year-old, a 12-year-old possibly commit? What could they possibly do on the face of God's green earth? What the hell could a child possibly do to make them feel deeply in their core, I am no good. I'm unimportant. I don't matter. What could possibly justify teaching a child that? Nothing.
Absolutely nothing.
Nothing. You are innocent, indisputably. And the mere fact that you can even allow yourself to see that is bigger than you realize, because I have clients who refuse to acknowledge that they need to hold on to the belief that my parents were good And so they will cling to this notion, I was the bad one. And they cannot bring themselves to indict the parent. Even if I tell them, you don't ever have to confront your parent. But they can't do it. Why? Because they realize if they sort of lose their lifeline, as one of my clients said, that, well, that means I've been alone the whole time. Yeah, it kind of does. And that's scary shit. And who do I have if I don't have them? Well, who have you had the whole time? You thought you had them, but they've never had your back, or it's been in and out or what have you. And so let me ask you, Jane Susan, what's going on inside of you right now?
I'm a little bit sad because, you know, I do, when you said, you know, you've been alone, like you made that statement about, you know, you've been alone the whole time. I feel that, I felt that way for a long time. I've been alone the whole time throughout all of these things that have happened to me. But I also, like I said before, I feel a little bit of relief because it's like, you know, like I said, I know that it wasn't me and that, you know, everything that goes wrong is not because of something that I did. And, you know, I think I feel a little bit better now about, you know, starting to journal and get some of the stuff out.
Right.
And maybe reading some of the letters.
Yeah, and exactly. I mean, think about it. If you believe that you're at fault for everything and you've been conditioned to believe that since you're a child, why the fuck would I want to go into my childhood and look at all these past pains and trauma? Because it's just going to remind me of how shitty I am. Yeah. Right? Exactly. But now we're like, no, that was never true to begin with. That was never, just out of curiosity, have you ever watched the movie Good Will Hunting?
Love that movie.
Right? I would encourage you to go back and watch that movie again. And especially the climactic scene where Matt Damon is counseling with Robin Williams at the end, and the whole sequence of events about it's not your fault, because that's going to ring very, very differently for you now. That's going to hit you like as hard as I could wallop you right in the chest right now. It's going to hit you that hard. Because that's exactly what you're realizing right now. And what that means is it wasn't your fault. What it means is now it doesn't have to be so scary to go into the past pain, to journal out, to let it out just bit by bit. Just take something little, the sad of right now, or journal about relief. That's a feeling. Just start small and then let it expand from there and allow yourself to feel those feelings. And the more you go into it a little bit, you'll sort of start to get your legs under you, and then you'll be like, okay, I can handle a little bit more. Then I can handle a medium one. And then, yeah, okay, I'm ready for a big one now. Let's go into this one, and so on and so forth. I have to ask, just as a point off topic, but I have to ask, have you ever told your mother, just out of curiosity, that you were raped by her best friend's husband?
Never.
Is your mother still alive?
She is.
What I'm just curious, and I'm not pushing you to do that in any way.
Yeah.
This is just my own curiosity. What would be the impact on your mother if you were to tell her that?
I'm not sure. She has a deep hatred for him because of the way he treated her, the best friend, like when she was diagnosed with cancer, mm-hmm. and then they got divorced after, mm-hmm. and there was a lot of.
But why
things
are you
happened.
Questioning whether or not or how she would respond? I'm just curious. Why do you? Would she believe you?
I think she would believe me, but I still have this little bit of a fear that she would blame me.
And let me ask you this: this is going to sound like a dumb question, but. Why do you fear her blaming you? What is it about that you fear so much? Because someone would have to be off the rocker, especially as a woman, because of the sexual vulnerability that women generally have in the world. Mm-hmm. As a woman, for her to then blame the victim, would she blame you because she actually thinks the woman is at fault, or she just blames you because you're just such a piece of shit? Why might she blame you, first of all? And second of all, why would that hurt in just a sentence or two?
Because she always, you know, makes comments about what a horrible teenager I was and what a pain in the ass I was.
So why would it hurt? And I know this is weird, but why would it hurt if she still either largely or entirely or even a little bit, why would it hurt if she blamed you? What is it about that that's so scary?
My whole life, it's like every choice I've made, she's always like, you know, it's like you said previously, well, you should do this. You should do this. Oh, did you gain weight? You know, why did you do this? You should do it this way. So it's
so is the difficulty in her blaming you, if she were to do that, even a small amount in your being raped as a teenage girl, is the real pain that it would hurt? First of all, of course it would hurt, but is the real pain, though, that it would confirm for you what a fucking, forgive me, piece of shit your mom has been, blaming your daughter for being raped at age 17? Would it confirm for you that perhaps that what you've always wanted from your mother, there is no chance you're ever going to get? That approval, that acceptance, that love. And is it possible that you don't want to feel that? You don't want to see how much she really hasn't loved you and protected you and so forth and protected your emotions and so forth. Is it possible you don't want to see it and don't want to feel it?
Absolutely.
What is the one thing above all else? And there's no right or wrong answer. What are you most still wanting from your mom? Is it attention, affection, approval, acceptance, acknowledgement of what she's done, apology, or is it something else completely? What is it above all else you are still wanting from your mother?
It's acceptance.
Acceptance. And you're 48 years old. What is the percentage likelihood you're still going to get that?
Well, she did tell me the other day she was proud of me, which was a huge step.
And how did it feel? Just out of curiosity, how did it feel?
It felt pretty good. It was,
really? Was there anything inside of you that said, fuck you, where was this 40 fucking years ago?
Yeah, part of me was like, oh, it's about fucking time,
exactly,
lady.
So let me ask you this. If you got full acceptance from your mother, then what?
Probably that same feeling, like about fucking time.
And,
but, you know.
But you're still wanting it. So if you got it, then what? In your life, then what?
Right. Well, that's, you know, it's funny because I've asked myself that because I've heard you
and
say
what's
that.
Your and answer? What's your answer?
I don't know. Like, and that's what I've been trying to answer. Cause I'm like, well,
what
then
would it feel?
Like,
what would it feel? What would it feel inside?
Part of me is like, kind of like, fuck you. I
right?
finally got
what's
it.
The other part? What's the other part? I have to be in addition to the fuck you. What's the other part?
Like, oh, I'm finally worth something.
I'm finally worth something. In other words, your sense of self-worth is almost entirely, if not entirely, in the hands of another person, first of all. Second of all, the very person, one of two people, who taught you not your non-self-worth. So you are saying, only my mother has the power to heal me. I am in a jail cell and she has the key, and only she has the key. If she accepts me, then I can like myself. But in fact, the key is in your own pocket. You can heal self. You can love self, confirm your own worth, but you are giving your mother supreme power over your worth. She is still, at age 48, God.
Mm.
She is God.
And I know that, but I don't know how to make that not be the truth.
The way you do that is, I would strongly recommend that you begin to journal every single memory that you have of your mother. Good, bad, ugly, indifferent, father as well, but each parent separately, and then begin to attach what feelings are attached to that, or how do you feel about it now? Even if you don't have a memory of what you felt then, how do you feel about it now? Because we can look at her, you know, some of the shit that she did now, you and me talking about it as adults, it's like, what the actual fuck were you thinking, woman? You know, talking about your mom, not about you, talking about your mom. And so we can feel the rage, we can feel the anger, we can feel the sadness, the disappointment, et cetera. What was that?
Oh, no, I said, I understand that. Yeah.
Yep. And so begin to list all of those things that your mother did, didn't do, and allow, welcome the feelings. And the more you do it, just a little bit, and write it out. I'm actually feeling mad right now. Wow. Yes. I feel a feeling. This is fucking awesome. Okay, fuck you, old woman, because you did this to me. And you never have to confront your mother in real life, but you need to begin to gin up all of the past. And the more, and that relief that you told me that you felt a few minutes ago, you're going to feel that more and more. But in order for those feelings to leave you, they got to come up and pass through you. You got to welcome them up. And they're going to hurt. They're going to feel heavy. But the more you release them, you're going to feel lighter and you're going to have so much more fucking clarity. Does that sound somewhat doable?
It does.
Yeah. And you need to go back into the book because all the prompts are there and that will help you. But now you're going to see it differently. You're going to read that book differently after today, especially after the piece of, holy shit, it wasn't my fault. You're going to just see the whole equation differently. Jane Susan, I want to thank you so much for being on the show. I hope you'll stick around for a moment after the show. I want to thank you so much for being on the show. What a great, great story. And what a cool fucking new realization, revelation. That's awesome.
You are wonderful. Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. You're welcome. And so to everyone who's been listening, thank you so much for tuning into the what's the name of our show, Rob?
The Badass Counseling Show.
Oh, you bobbled it a little bit there, too. It wasn't just me.
I wanted to make you feel better.
And that's the mark of a good host, people. If you're at a party and somebody, one of your guests drops a glass, be the host and drop a glass. That way they don't feel bad. Anyway, that's one theory. All right. I love you all. Thank you all, my badasses, tuning in around the world. This has been another kick-ass episode of the Badass Counseling Show. On behalf of Rob the Rocket and KC in the booth, have a kick-ass day.
The Badass Counseling Show is strictly copyrighted. No copies may be made without the express written consent of the Badass Counseling Show, LLC. The Badass Counseling Show is produced by Karen Camparelli and Robert H. Friedman. Executive producer, Sven Erlandson. Original music by 2-time Emmy Award-winning composer, Trevor Morris. Have a kick-ass day.